Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhouse. This week, a conversation with film critic Molly Haskell about Hollywood during the Cold War.
And so a lot of the writers, they were Jewish intellectuals who'd gone to Hollywood to write, but not only feared the blacklist, but got some of these themes sort of subversively but covertly into the films.
Leslie Kaufman has notes from the field. Liesl Schillinger explores the world of high fashion.
And she was just this fashion arbiter who made people think that Americans could be fashionable too.
And Greg Coles has bestseller news. Old Hollywood grows more and more attractive and also more interesting as time passes on. And there are two important new books. One's called The Entertainer, Movies, Magic, and My Father's 20th Century by the journalist Margaret Talbot. The other is The Noir 40s, The American People from Victory to Cold War by Richard Lingerman. It's reviewed for us by very distinguished film critic Molly Haskell, reviewed on a cover, who joins us on the phone. Welcome, Molly.
Thank you, Sam.
All right. So we're going back to what you call the political and sociological shifts in America at large in this kind of Cold War period. How did film reflect or capture that?
Well, in many ways, I think that's what's interesting. Lingerman calls his book Noir 40s, and he's talking about more than film noir, but of course that's the central sort of conceit of it. And he's had experience in this of returning home from war. He was in the Korean War, the end of the Korean War, and that feeling of dislocation when you get home, and especially in the Second World War. I think the First World War was very different. I think people just felt that their politicians were selling them out, whereas in the Second World War, they took it more personally. They felt many of the soldiers felt emasculated by the loss and powerlessness and that sense of not necessarily being welcome when they came home. They were paranoid about what their wives had been doing in their absence. Women were going into the workforce. So you had all these different social forces at once feeding into film noir. And then, of course, red baiting. This was a period when the House Un-American Activities Committee was at its work, and Hollywood formed its own blacklist. And so a lot of the writers, they were Jewish intellectuals who'd gone to Hollywood to write, but not only feared the blacklist, but got some of these themes sort of subversively but covertly into the films.
And in her book, Margaret Talbot, who's a very fine journalist that many of our listeners will know from her New Yorker essays and before that for the New York Times Sunday Magazine, has actually written about her father, who turned out to be a film actor of some consequence.
He was, and it's kind of a marvelous story because it's the kind you never hear about. You hear about the stars or the almost stars, and here's somebody who is like almost a star. And he started out in showbiz and carnivals and freak shows, and he just did a little bit of everything. And then suddenly he was in Hollywood, and he was very good-looking. He had a great name, Lyle Talbot. That was his real name. He didn't have to change it. And he got a contract with Warner Brothers.
And what is the larger story Talbot is telling? Does this take us inside sort of the Hollywood of that time, or the life of the, as you say, the almost star? What does she take away from this experience?
Well, I think most of it is that sort of the mutating forms of American culture. And the theater was very Victorian when he started out, and then that changed, and he adapted to that, and then Hollywood was calling, and then there was the star system, which was in its infancy at that time. And he sort of was ready for anything. And I think it tells us, in the end, she sort of wonders why he never became a star. But I think that the real story is how he did as well as he did. He didn't really have great talent. He wasn't all that individual. You know, he didn't have a kind of face or persona that you remembered from film to film. And yet he kept working. And very few people, you know, out of 1,000 people that would be signed contracts every year, only something like 7 or 8 would become stars. 7 or 8 would become maybe character actors of some note, and then the rest were just footnotes. And so she's bringing him up from his footnote and giving him kind of a feature playing role now.
Molly, there's a lot of nostalgia today for the glamour of the old Hollywood studio system. Was something lost when that went away, or are we better off without it?
Well, I think the celebrity culture is not a whole lot of improvement. I mean, it's gotten away from that. People do their own press now. We don't have the, I think the studios, they own actors, so that was awful, and they always just were high-handed. They didn't pay them. They rejected the unions. They did everything they could to bust the unions. So they were really despotic employers. On the other hand, they really put time and money into making stars, into the lighting of them, the dressing of them, figuring out what type they were, and promoting them. So that I think what you've lost is that sense of a star, a continuity of a star persona from film to film. So you would go to a Bette Davis film or a Katharine Hepburn film and know what you were getting, whereas now the stars don't have anything. There's nothing consistent from year to year in there. So that, you know, you lose something and you gain something.
Thanks so much, Molly.
Okay.
That's Molly Haskell, who reviews The Entertainer and the Noir 40s on the cover of this week's book review. Leslie Kaufman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, Sam.
So, end of the year cheer, 50 Shades of Grey is maybe transformed into some shades of green?
Yes, we called it 5,000 Shades of Green. We couldn't help ourselves. We had a little news scoop out of Random House. At their Christmas party, the boss stood up and said, $5,000 for every employee. And we're talking editors all the way down to the folks in the distribution centers who were packing the boxes.
Each one is getting, presumably, a check for $5,000?
That is correct.
Sign me up. So what's the cause? 50 Shades of Grey has a lot to do with it.
Right, sure. So 50 Shades of Grey has been an incredible phenomena. They estimate 35 million books this year alone in America, probably more than 60 million overseas. That's a lot of money all in one year.
Now, Leslie, just so our listeners get it, if Random House controls the rights, because it was a British publication, are they also profiting from all these foreign sales or from some of them? How does that work?
Well, right. They don't get all the foreign sales. So it was actually with an Australian house. They had to buy it. So they paid a fair amount to have it. But they don't have distribution rights in all the foreign countries. But they do have Britain, I'm sure. And I'm not sure where else they have. But they have a bunch of countries. So they don't profit from all those sales. But they're profiting, obviously, well enough to be generous with the folk.
Wow, good for them. And is it just because of 50 Shades of Grey, or have they had other successes too?
No, Random House, as they say, has had a very good year. On the bestseller list right now, topping How To and Miscellaneous, is Ina Garten, always a reliable source.
What book is that?
That's her cookbook, and her latest cookbook. She's the Barefoot Contessa. I always love her recipes, so good for her. And also, they've had another surprise in Gone Girl from Gillian Flynn that is staying right up there on the bestseller lists. I think they said a million copies of that as well. So lots to cheer about over at Random House.
Now, is this a zero-sum game, or have other publishers also done pretty well? You've done some reporting on this.
I have done a little reporting. You know, I had a lunch the other day with an editor over at HarperCollins. They had a great year. Penguin is saying it's been a pretty good year. So it's not the end of the publishing industry quite yet. I had the head of Chronicle Books in here. He said they had their best year in 45 years this year.
And Leslie, do we have any sense then that the publishers have found a way to make ebooks and reading on different devices and platforms profitable? Or is it still too soon to tell?
I have to say from my reporting, I'm not sure where the big money is coming from, but it seems like a lot of it's coming from some hardcover sales as well. I mean, Chronicle Books has 1%, 2% digital publishing, and they're still having a great year. So there's lots of money to be made in hardcover still.
Leslie, books are still kind of expensive, especially if you get them as bound books. What about a book like Chris Ware's Building Stories? How's that doing?
Chris Ware's Building Stories is doing great out there. The independent bookstores say they can't, literally cannot keep it in stock. This is a $50 price tag, and it's running out the door.
And one of our 10 best books of the year.
And one of your 10 best books of the year. They were very grateful for that, by the way, that you're giving best books of the year to $50 books. Those are $50 books.
Well, you know, now that you mention these very high price points, as they call them, Leslie, are we talking about strong sales in actual brick-and-mortar bookstores, or is this Amazon, Amazon, Amazon?
No. I've been calling around, especially to the independent bookstores, to see what their Christmas sales. They all tell me that they're up over Thanksgiving. And this year, Christmas shopping has an extra weekend in it from last year. So they're saying this is going to be a strong year, and they are seeing particularly some of the hard, expensive hardcover books going out the door.
That's fantastic. Thanks so much, Leslie.
Happy to be here.
Like many others, I have gotten my first glimpse into the world of fashion by watching Project Runway, addictive television. So some of the icons in that world have now become giants or giantesses to me. There are three new books that penetrate that world. The first is called Empress of Fashion, A Life of Diana Vreeland by Amanda Mackenzie Stewart. The second is Diana Vreeland, The Eye Has to Travel, by Lisa Immordino Vreeland. And the third is Grace, a Memoir by, yes, Grace Coddington with Michael Roberts. They're all three are reviewed for us by the great Liesl Schillinger, who's kind of an icon or iconess herself, and she's here to talk about them. Welcome, Liesl.
Hello, Sam.
So Vreeland just gets bigger and bigger. She's this kind of giant of modern culture. How come?
Well, she's just immortal. When people say larger than life, they sometimes apply it as an exaggeration, but it is no exaggeration in her case. The woman was excessive, and she had such passions. And, you know, I don't know how many people under 40 know who Diana Vreeland is, you know, the famous editrix of Harper's Bazaar and Vogue. But when I came to New York ages ago, I went to see a play about her called Full Gallop with the amazing Mary Louise Wilson acting as Diana Vreeland. And I didn't know in 1995 really who that was, Diana Vreeland. But you see this woman who's dropping lines like she's Noel Coward or Oscar Wilde, and her cheeks are rouged bright red, and she describes her living room as looking like a garden in hell, and everything is, you know, lacquered to the ultimate shininess. She painted her hair black, and she was just this fashion arbiter who made people think that Americans could be fashionable too. She was very Parisian in sensibility, but she is the person who did so much to bring the mantle of high fashion to New York, and to the extent that we have Bryant Park and the fashion shows here, and people think of New York as being up there with Paris and Milan, Diana Vreeland has a whole lot to do with that.
And what was her great period?
Well, she was at Harper's Bazaar. She was an heiress and of a kind, and she married an extremely handsome man whom she adored named Reed Vreeland. But her mother was a notorious socialite and big game hunter who got involved in sex scandals and was very cruel to her.
And when was this?
This was in, well, Diana was born in 1903, so I'm now talking like the teens. I'm talking New York in the jazz age. But so she married this handsome man in the 20s and went and hung out in London, and Cecil Beaton painted her. Everyone loved her because she gave great parties. She was a fantastic talker, a ridiculous and eccentric, unforgettable dresser. She was the kind of person who made your life feel gilded just by, or being dropped with crystal specks just by
being
around
company.
Her.
Yeah. And what do these books tell us? Do they really open up the life?
They do. And there are three books here. One is Empress of Fashion about Diana Vreeland. And that lets you know essentially how mean her mother was to her and how much her brilliant career was her own act of self-invention, because she believed in her destiny. She said, there's only one good life, and it's the one that you define and you make it happen for yourself.
And where was she from? Where was she born?
She's born in Paris, and she always lied creatively and embellished the romance of her past. But she went to Brearley, which she hated, and then went to a different school.
Oh, they're very exclusive private school here in Manhattan.
Right, yeah. Right. But she was always an eccentric girl. Like, when she went to her debutante party, she covered her face in white plaster because she wanted to look like a lily. So it's as if she had whitewashed her face, and she wore red camellias, which were something that French courtesans, I mean, it was positively indecent, but then she met this, you know, gorgeous man and married him. And so she turned into the flower, the gorgeous oriental flower she wanted to be. She painted her nails before women did that, before society girls did that.
Was she a hard worker?
Well, she was an endlessly, tirelessly inventive person, but, you know, she was seen dancing at the St. Ridge's roof with her husband, and Carmel Snow of Harper's Bazaar said, oh, look at you, come and work for me at Harper's Bazaar. So she fell into work. She hadn't really been a day job kind of person, but she worked at Harper's Bazaar from the 30s to 60s, then at Vogue for a very important decade in the 60s. She brought black models to Vogue. She discovered Mick Jagger. I mean, Diana Vreeland had an eye for what mattered, what changed, what was hot. She really cared about youth, so she was flexible. And the second book I reviewed in here is a picture book of all of the work she did at those magazines and also for the Costume Institute, which she turned into a phenomenon at the Met after she was fired from Vogue when she was almost 70. She reinvented herself. So her granddaughter, it's not her granddaughter, it's her grandson Alexander's wife, Lisa, put together this amazing photo collage of her photo shoots and of her signature exhibitions at the Met.
And are they still striking to the eye to see these things, visually striking?
What Diana did is she made us understand we should be looking at them as if they were art and culture. People, she called, you know, Hollywood and got all of the iconic outfits worn by Garbo and I don't know who all else. I can't remember. But one of her early exhibitions was on the glamour of Hollywood. She did another one on Russia. You know, I remember women wearing sort of Russian peasant outfits in the 70s. That kind of grew out of this exhibit that Diana Vreeland brought to the Met of Russian furs and so forth. So she was someone who made Americans think that we could be fashionable. We weren't all just dull, ready to wear. We could make a splash. And so when you see women on Project Runway, they're picking up on Diana Vreeland's legacy. Now, a person that we think of now as following Diana Vreeland's legacy is Anna Wintour, who's the editor of Vogue.
And a huge figure in the culture in New York, in politics now. She's a very big person.
She is immense. She is enigmatic. She is influential, and she is charming. And she edits Vogue. She inspires a lot of fear because she's very powerful. I'm sure you've heard of the movie The Devil Wears Prada, written by a disgruntled woman who answered phones for a while at Vogue and then made a brilliant career by writing her Romana Clay about that. But
And played by Meryl Streep in the
That's
the
right. Yeah. And Anne Hathaway.
There was also a documentary about the making of a single issue of Vogue, and the star became not Anna Wintour so much as Grace Coddington, whose book you also review. Tell us about her.
Well, Grace Coddington is a behind-the-scenes person whom people hadn't known so much about. If you see her around town at the fashion shows, she's impressive because she's tall and ethereal and wraith-like with this huge, huge cloud of flame-red hair, which her longtime partner Didier creates for her. It's this intense orange. But she's Welsh, and she is the person who magics up a scene so that when you see photo spreads in Vogue, it takes your breath away. That's what Grace Coddington does. And so what she does is creative work. But this book is a memoir in which she quite simply goes sort of from A to Z in recapping her life and describing the men she loved, her breakthrough as a model in London in the swinging 60s in London.
Right, sort
she
of
was
in the
terrible
Twiggy
car
era,
accident.
Right?
Oh, she was. Yes, it was in the Twiggy era.
Yeah.
But she won Vogue's New Idea contest when she was, I think, 19. So her start came from Vogue, and then she ended up working for Anna's Vogue in 1988.
And when was the car accident? What was that?
That was when that would have been, I think it was around 1960. I can't remember.
But she was young then.
She was only about 19, and she was dating a dashing man in a dashing car, and she had an accident. But she continued to model even after that. She was a striking, slender woman. She reminds me a little of the model Karen Elson from Now. So in the movie, the September issue, the R.J. Cutler documentary, she was seen to be disgruntled, and she was grumbling under her breath, saying, "Oh, don't say that. You'll get the sack, I suppose." You know. So she was sort of complaining as people were trying to make these photo shoots and very afraid that Anna Wintour would or would not like
them. And she's
them.
Not intimidated by Anna Wintour. Is that part of the story?
Well, they are genuine friends. But of course, anyone's intimidated by their boss, you know, because you can fall out of favor. You can get burnt by the sun, as some people say. But so Grace wrote this memoir because there was so much interest in her for being so truculent on film, even though what came across in the September issue was her passion for the scenes she creates for the magazine and Anna Wintour's passion. And that also comes through in, I should say, the movie documentary version of Diana Vreeland's life, which her granddaughter, as I reviewed, created in a picture book called The Eye Has to Travel, which had lots of text too, but that's also a documentary that's playing in theaters right now.
Now, Lisa, you are going off to Moscow today. You're going to be flying there.
Yes.
And will you keep an eye on fashion there? Is this something you always do? You want to know what everybody's wearing and how they look? And
Don't laugh. The Russian women are extremely stylish, and they are ahead of us, and they really care. And so,
there are also
yes,
many great beauties in Russia, no?
Oh, yes.
Daughters of Anna Karenina.
Krasavitsi. Well, you know, Anna Karenina is coming out. A friend of mine who are going, we're both taking fur muffs, and we want to go ice skating like Kitty and Levin. But I love Moscow. It's a magical city, and they really understand glamour. So it's also going to be 17 degrees there. So I'll discover Russian winter. But yes, no, Russia, Moscow is a fashion capital. The women really still believe in женственность, as they call it, which is womanliness. So I'm looking forward to getting an infusion of that over there.
Well, you don't need any. Thanks so much, Liesl.
Bye-bye, Sam.
That was Liesl Schillinger, who this week reviews three books on fashion in the book review. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
Tell us about the list this week.
Well, you know, the days are getting shorter and colder and people are staying home and not buying books, apparently. There are just two new books on the list, one on the fiction side and one on the nonfiction side. On the fiction side, it's redeemed a little by being new all the way at number one, which is Tom Clancy's latest, written with Mark Greene. That's called Threat Vector.
Stop, listeners. For the first time, I'm guessing, in most of your lives, you've heard the words Tom Clancy and redeemed used in the same sentence. What about nonfiction?
Nonfiction, the only new book is at number 12, and that is Calvin Trillin's latest book of deadline poetry, as he calls it, called Dogfight, which is a look back at the 2012 presidential campaign.
He writes this kind of doggerel for The Nation magazine.
Exactly. It's light verse. It is sort of satire, commentary on the political scene. In this book, he mostly looks at the Republican side of things, largely because that's where all the action was.
Well, and the jokes.
Exactly. He has a lot of fun with the primaries. One of the poems in there is called Callista Gingrich, aware that her husband has cheated on and then left two wives who had serious illnesses, tries desperately to make light of a bad cough.
And you also did a little holiday business yourself, right? You got in touch with some quite prominent authors and asked them about their gift-giving habits.
Yeah, it's become a bit of a tradition for the Inside the List column at this time of year. We reach out to best-selling authors from the previous year and ask what they're giving for the holidays, what they're wishing for the holidays. I talked to five authors this year, including Maria Semple, who wrote Where'd You Go, Bernadette?
That's the funny Seattle novel.
That's right. It's sort of a mystery and a satire about Seattle. She said that she always buys just one book in bulk and gives it away to all of her friends. And this year, the book that she settled on was Ben Fountain's Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk.
Finalist for the National Book Award.
That's right. It's an Iraq war novel, but also a comedy. And it's set during halftime of a Dallas Cowboys football game. So it's poking fun at a lot of American sacred cows.
And who else did you talk to?
Jess Walter, the author of Beautiful Ruins, chose a variety of books, including a poetry collection by a woman named Natalie Diaz. Her book is called When My Brother Was an Aztec. He also picked a book that came out last year, Ben Lerner's novel, Leaving the Atocha Station. Lauren Groff's novel from this year, Arcadia, which is a beautifully written book, a book that I liked a lot myself. And a book of comics and essays by a guy named Tim Kreider. His book is called We Learn Nothing. Then I talked to Junot Diaz, the author of This Is How You Lose Her, which was on the list earlier this year.
Also a finalist.
Yes, also a finalist for the National Book Award.
But he's won every prize there is, and he's been in for we've done the podcast with him on the phone.
It was really a good year for quality books making the bestseller list.
In fact, Greg, didn't you calculate that all 10 of the book reviews, 10 best books of the year, were at one time or another on the bestseller list this year?
You know, I thought that was the case. That was my memory. But in going back and looking at it for a possible column item, I found that 9 of the 10 were. The one that was not just barely missed it, Dave Eggers' Hologram for a King, was at number 16 on the extended list. But it never did crack the print version.
But still a bestseller then.
Remarkable. That's right. It was on the extended list. It was still a New York Times bestseller.
So you went to Junot Diaz, and what's he giving?
He also picked poetry and comics, just like Jess Walter did. The poetry collection that he picked was, again, a National Book Award finalist, Tim Sybils' collection, Fast Animal. And the graphic novel memoir that he picked is by a woman, a young cartoonist named Christy C. Rode. Her memoir is called Spit and Passion. Then I talked to Cheryl Strayed, who had two bestsellers this year with Wild and her advice book, Tiny Beautiful Things. She is planning to give Alice Munro's new book, Dear Life, to friends of hers. And she's hoping to get a memoir by a woman named Suzanne Roberts called Almost Somewhere, which is an account of a month-long hike she took on the John Muir Trail back in the early 90s. And finally, I talked to Gillian Flynn, who was probably the runaway bestseller this year with her book Gone Girl.
And also kind of the big surprise, too, the book that came from nowhere.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I think, her third novel, and she's filled a niche of writing kind of very literary, dark mysteries. This is a book that is about a wife who's gone missing and is suspected dead. Her husband is the chief suspect in her disappearance. But it really turns into kind of a profile of a marriage and a look at the dark underside of marriage. It's still on the list. It's sold millions of copies, and it's spent over half a year on the list so far, including a number of weeks at number one.
So what book is she giving?
She said that she's fascinated with the post-apocalyptic novel, and she's planning to give a number of her friends a book called The Dog Stars. It's a debut novel by Peter Heller. Her comment on it was so lovely and lyrical and un-zombie-filled. I found it incredible.
You know, one thing this shows is that just the extent to which writers read, which is something people don't often realize. They read very broadly and widely.
Many of them also don't when they're working on projects of their own. They don't want to be influenced by other voices. They don't have the time when they're working on a project of their own to read other people. In talking to people for this column and just writers that I know in my life and also approaching people for assignments, I find it's a real mix. It's probably about 50-50. Some people read everything they can to keep up and to you know, get thinking of new ideas, and other people are really reluctant to read others while they're working on their own work.
While they're working, but then when they're not working, it seems it's one of the things they do is
I think most writers really started out as readers, and it's something that they love to do. Gillian Flynn did pick another few books. She is going to give some people the Richard Lloyd Perry true crime account, People Who Eat Darkness, which is set in Japan, about a killer there. She is going to be giving copies of Maria Semple's book, Where'd You Go, Bernadette, which she called one of the big burst of oxygen books this year. And then the books that she's wishing for include Ken Follett's Winter of the World, Louise Erdrich's Roundhouse, and Jess Walter's Beautiful Ruins. And when I told her, hey, Jess is participating in the column, you know, maybe he'll send you a copy, she said, I can always hope.
Thanks so much, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our show is produced by John Williams and Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can write to us at books@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.